Steve Piatz joins me this week to talk about making mead. This is Beersmith Podcast number 214.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 214, and it's early May 2020. Steve Piatz joins me this week to discuss making mead. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass, with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the Brew Commander, the new complete brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller with exact precision and the ultimate in flexibility. Whether integrated or freestanding, the Brew Commander offers automated step mashing, boil timers, and amazing advanced settings. Whatever your setup, the Brew Commander offers precision temperature control and repeatability. Command your brew day with a new Brew Commander from Blickman Engineering. To order yours today, visit BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith 3 brewing software a try. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider recipe support to the Beersmith platform, along with new integrated water profile and mash pH tools. Dozens of new features, including cloud folders, updated databases, support for fruit juice and honey, as well as new Whirlpool hop options for beer brewing. Download your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com and give it a try. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Steve Piatz. Steve is the author of the book, The Complete Guide to Mead Making, and was a 2008 Mead Maker of the Year. He's also a longtime mead maker and judge. Steve, it's great to have you on the show.
Good to be back, Brad.
So how have you been? What have you been up to up there in Minneapolis-St. Paul area?
Oh, I've been, playing a few different things while I'm doing my stay-at-home duty. Made some cheese, made some beer, packaged some meads, little fun things like that.
Have you been doing anything interesting in the mead world?
Not in the last few months. hasn't been much going on. I have got a couple I want to start up in the next couple days.
Yeah.
Going to do Quebec, if I pronounce that poorly. I want to do, I think it's a Hornendal strain. I'm gonna do with some fruit to try and, emphasize even more tropical character out of that.
You gonna make a Quebec mead?
Yeah.
That's interesting. I haven't heard of anybody doing that.
I'm sure somebody has.
I'm sure somebody has too, but yeah, probably ferment pretty quickly, I would think.
Maybe. I think, yeah. Oh. Yeah, I need my temperature controlled fermenter to become available so I can, keep the temperature up high enough.
Now, last time you were on, we were talking about session meads. Are you making, still making session meads? Or are you making different styles?
I make some small, some monsters, kind of a hit or miss.
I think I mentioned my favorite, of course, is the big fruit meads.
I make a lot of those. I've got a lot of those, in my 5-gallon stainless steel bottles, i.e. corny kegs.
Yep. I know today you wanted to cover a few different topics on mead making, but before we dive into some of the more advanced topics, I wanted to maybe just go over the basic mead making process, which is remarkably simple now. And in fact, I think most homebrewers have all the equipment at home to do it, basically.
Yep. Doesn't take much. No hot side. So need a big fermenter, some honey, some water, some nutrients, pretty readily available nutrient regimes these days, either Fermate-O, Fermate-K, maybe some DAP. Dried yeasts are readily available in wine type yeast. So it's pretty easy to put together, a little stirring and maybe a shot of oxygen, and that's about all there is to it. And a few weeks later,
Walk us through the basic process. So you start with basically water and honey would be a simple mead, right?
Yeah. Water and honey would be your quote traditional mead.
And I'm always amazed how much honey you can actually get into just a small amount of water.
Yeah, isn't it amazing? I mean, honey is probably better than 80% sugar, I guess, but even so, you can make a 5-gallon batch of mead and use 18 plus pounds of honey with no challenge, if you're going for high gravity. If you're making a small one, you could, lower gravity, you use a lot less honey. But still, it's water, honey, you mix them together, you add some nutrients a couple times, you add your yeast right at the beginning. If you're using dried yeast, best to use some rehydration nutrients just to help it get a head start. And for the most part, people end up then with a nice, clean, rapid fermentation. They don't get stuck. Things work out really easily for most people.
Walk through the nutrient schedule, too. I mean, most of us use, Tonsa-2 or something like that.
Yeah, Tonsa-2 are one of those derivatives of that. Tonsa, the T-O-S-N-A, the T-O is totally organic, and that would mean you're using Fermato only as a nutrient, because Fermato is organic versus Fermade K, which has other nutrients in it as well. And then the alternative, the little older style, was Fermade K and DAP, diammonia phosphate.
Right.
So they both work. The nutrient schedule for the modern Tonsa-2 kind of approach, people would mix up the must, the mead, sugar and water mixture, perhaps fruit. Today, tomorrow, they'd put the first dose of nutrients in, they'd put another dose in the day after and the day after, and then the final fourth of the nutrients would go in at the point where a third of the sugar is fermented away.
So, I mean, it only takes really a couple of days to do the nutrients. And then talk for us for a minute about the importance of degassing, which is something you really don't do with beer, obviously.
Obviously, yeah. When you tell beer people you're going to stir the bejesus out of your fermenting wort, they get a little paranoid. So the idea there is that you're driving out a lot of the carbon dioxide. It kind of helps the yeast function better. In reality, I haven't been doing that for the most part in my batches for a while now, in part because there was perhaps no scientific justification for it, other than by stirring, I got more oxygen into the fermenting wort along the way, which was good for the yeast. And it also degassed so that when I added the powdered nutrients, it didn't foam up and make a terrible mess.
Mm-hmm. I think doesn't degassing help it go a little bit faster because the yeast isn't fighting the carbonic acid that's forming?
Probably, and I haven't done side-by-sides, unfortunately. For years I did the degassing, but like I said, recently I have given that up. And the way to avoid the big gushing by putting the dried nutrients in it is to take a small sample of the must into a sterile measuring cup or something, mix the nutrients in gently into there, and then dump the liquid back into the bigger fermenter, and then you don't get the big foam up. But it either way works. Obviously, the CO2 that's being generated by the fermentation, some of it will stay in solution during fermentation. Winemakers know that, before bottling, they have to degas so they don't have anything left in their bottles. But you can't get a lot of CO2 dissolved when you don't have pressure. So it isn't going to get super high.
Yeah.
So stirring is fine. I've done it for a long time. I don't think it's essential
anymore. Interesting. And then, of course, the big thing you need, most, like I said, most brewers have the equipment. They have, it's really easy to get honey. But the big thing you need is patience, right? It takes a little bit longer to make mead than it does your typical mead than it does your typical beer, right?
Well, yeah, in terms of wall time, just a little bit more. In terms of the actual total amount of your effort you put in is probably less in terms of hours I spend, producing an all grain beer. I can mix up quite a few batches of mead in the same amount of wall time, and there isn't a whole lot of ongoing time I put in after the mix up. It's only a few minutes per day that I have to put into them after the initial start.
And then virtually nothing after that. I mean, yeah. I make fairly big needs, but usually within around 60 to 90 days, they're kind of in the drinkable stage anyways, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And so you can have the mead ready to drink. Literally, I've known some of my friends to make them in 3, 4, 5 days. That isn't to say that they won't get better with aging, things sometimes meld together better, particularly on some big fruit meads. But those are, small optimizations that go on in after the bulk of the fermentation is over. And so just like a good red wine is going to change over time, but the winemaker's big effort was in the first few weeks or months.
Right, right. And so you age the meat out, and I mean, how many times do you transfer it? Usually I transfer mine at least once or twice while it's aging. I don't know.
Yeah, it kind of depends, and sometimes it depends on if I have time available to in another fermenter to put it into. I do my primaries in a large plastic fermenter generally for my meads, unless I'm trying to do some temperature control work. And so I don't want to leave them in there for more than maybe 3, 4 weeks in general. And then I'll get them into glass. And then I'll periodically rack off a lot of the sediment. In some cases, I may actually want to leave them on the sediment. For example, if I'm making something like, say, a Chardonnay Piment, where aging on the leaves is a part of the character of the Chardonnay wine, then I want to have that character come along. And so I have to age. But
Chardonnay and Champagne and several other varieties of wine are aged purposely on the yeast cake, and it helps smooth out the wine, right?
Yeah. And in fact, the purest winemakers would say, well, no, you actually have to even stir up the sediment. You don't want it to just lay on the bottom.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yeah, I'm not quite that into it, but I do leave it on the sediment. I think it helps in the case of those kinds of piments. But those are kind of specialized cases.
And then one of the topics you said to talk about today was stabilization of the meads, which of course is very important. It happens during this aging process typically at some point. Can you talk about when you stabilize the mead and how you go about doing it?
Sure. So to stabilize the mead, what you're doing is you're trying to keep you fermented the mead, the bulk of fermentation's over. And perhaps the mead is finished at 1.000 on your hydrometer, maybe even a little lower. It's bone dry. Mm-hmm. And you want to stabilize it and probably sweeten it. You can't do that in many cases by just adding some kind of sweetener, sugar or whatever, honey.
You're talking about batch sweetening, of course, which is a technique to get sweetness back into a very dry mead. Yeah.
But of course, if there's still yeast in there that's able to ferment, it will, and you're just going to make more alcohol out of that sweetness. So the stabilization process is kind of a multi-phase thing. First, you want to get as much yeast out as you can, which means usually you want the mead to drop pretty clear. I don't filter my meads to do this, but I want them to drop pretty bright. And so I may have to find them to get to that point. And then the stabilization requires adding some sulfites, potassium metabisulfite is the traditional salt used. And then after that, if I'm going to add sweetener, then I also add potassium sorbate. And between those two, I then preserved the mead and prevented it from restarting fermentation.
So sulfites are used. Potassium metabisulfite is used very widely in the wine industry, right? And it, yeah. I think, it provides a protection against oxidation and also spoilage, correct, right?
And of course, it's received a bad rap. A lot of people are terrified of it, adding it to their mead/wines. Well, it's got this bad character, you know, people don't like it. Well,
and then there's certain people that are supposed to be sulfite sensitive or something.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of like, you know, a lot of the other ones, perhaps you're gluten intolerant, maybe you're not, but you think you are, whatever. In the case of sulfites, there are naturally occurring ones in wines and meats. So there is some at the end of fermentation that's just the natural byproduct of the fermentation and the ingredients. So it's not without them, even if you don't add them. But what we're going to do is we want to get them to probably a higher level than the natural would have provided. I don't currently have an SO2 meter.
Probably, but you can get sulfite test kits. I picked one up early on. It's a little titration kind of thing. It's not real easy to use, but you can get an idea, right?
Yeah, they use a dye indicator and some sodium hydroxide, and you do a test to watch the color change, and you can measure approximately how much SO2 there is currently. From a technical point of view, the perfect way to stabilize is you'd like to know the pH of your mead and how much SO2 there already is in the solution.
So if I had a pH meter and in one of these little sulfite test kits, I should be able to get very close, right?
Right. And in fact, what I do is I use a spreadsheet that's available on the Modern Mead Makers group on Facebook. In the files section, there's a spreadsheet that's been updated a few times over the years. I don't even remember who produced it anymore, but I'm sure it's in the revision history, that you enter the, you know, the batch size and the pH if you know it, and the, you know, free SO2 if you know it, and then, you know, it tells you how many grams of potassium metabisulfite you should add to stabilize your mead or wine.
Yeah. I actually have it built into Beersmith as well as a tool. There's a tool in Beersmith to do it, but very similar. It uses, I think most of these are using kind of a wine guidelines recommend a fairly low sulfite level, actually. You're working at what, like 50 to 100 or something like that?
Yeah, it's not, you don't need a huge amount, but you do need some, and it is pH sensitive. And so more acidic meads, you need less.
So one of the questions I had, if you're working with some of these, you know, really big fruit meads that have a really high finishing gravity, do you need to bump the sulfite levels up a little bit to protect them a little more?
If I'm making a sack strength mead, I cannot recall having ever stabilized, actually. No.
Interesting.
For a long-term storage point of view, that's probably a no-no.
Yeah, I would think you'd want a little bit of sulfite, at least some sulfites in there. I agree. You don't need the sorbates.
Yeah. If you're going to keep it around for a long time, that would be not the thing to do. I mean, if you're going to keep it for years, you really want to have some SO2 in there. It helps protect it from oxygen, and so it's going to last longer.
Yeah, I mean, I have several of these big meads that I made 3-4 years ago, and they're quite yummy still. But you're absolutely right. You do need, I think, a little bit of sulfite to protect them.
Yeah, and if you're going to try and keep them around for even longer, I have a friend who every year on his anniversary, he and his wife share a bottle from, you know, the year they got married, and, you know, I think I just saw a posting that he said the 20th one. Well, I hope he put lots of sulfite in at this point, because that's the point where it would start really paying off.
Yeah, you get leakage through the corks and stuff like that too, right?
Yeah.
So let's talk me through the other half of this, which of course is the sorbates, right?
Yeah, and the sorbate. So if you're going to back sweeten, you want to sorbate to prevent renewed fermentation from starting. So really, so
it doesn't kill the yeast, as I understand it. Right. It just inhibits it.
Unfortunately, right? There's a lot of misinformation out there. The potassium metabisulfite also doesn't kill the yeast, but it does significantly inhibit it. And it also inhibits all the spoilage organisms. Then the sorbate, I believe, from a technical point of view, what it does is it keeps any yeast cells that are present from reproducing. So, and a yeast cell can only ferment so long, and then it just kind of wears out. And if it can't produce any offspring, then quickly the fermentation is going to end.
Right.
So you add the sorbate, and again, this is going to be pH and alcohol sensitive. And the equations are, you know, pretty straightforward if you want to use them. I'm sure you have them in Beersmith as well.
Yeah, I do.
And the idea there is you add the right amount, a few grams per batch, wait about 24 hours is my usual case the next day. And then you can add your sweetness.
Interesting. Here's another question for you. So I've read online that you can get some geranium off flavors if you add the sorbates like immediately with the sulfates. Is there a reason to separate those or not?
I normally wait till the next day, but I know many people that don't. The actual cause of the germanium characteristic is from lactic acid bacteria. And so the real big no-no for using sorbate is if you've done a malolactic fermentation. Not many winemakers do that. Some winemakers do. You should never add sorbate because the malolactic fermentation is done by a lactic acid bacteria. And so you're guaranteed to have some present, and sorbate will instantly generate that geranium flavor. I did that once in a cider and didn't realize that that was what was going to happen until it was too late. Man, was that vile.
Is that a risk?
You'll never do it a second time.
Is that a risk with certain yeast that will metabolize the acid, the malic acid,
no,
or not?
No, it is not.
So not, like 71B I'm thinking of is...
No, because I do it frequently with 71B and it's not a problem. I think it literally is a lactic acid bacteria. I don't remember if it's strain specific. So the idea of the potassium metabisulfite is that addition is going to really wipe out the lactic acid bacteria.
Okay. So if you have, maybe you're not working with a absolutely pure yeast strain, or you got some wild bacteria in there, then you could be at risk for this geranium flavor. I guess we had them at the same time.
Yeah, that's probably the only way you'd get it. And I think the other way, probably lots of ones I've judged have ended up with it, is probably they were afraid of using the proper amount of potassium metabisulfite, so they didn't wipe out any of those contaminants before they added the sorbate.
Yeah, and I can think of one particular batch. I made, I think it was a cranberry mead, and I made it, and it was nice for about 6 months, and then it just went completely off, you know.
Yeah.
Thinking back, I don't think I added any sulfite to it, so.
Yeah. But live and learn, right?
Yeah. It was disappointing because it was quite yummy up front.
Yeah. But so, it's really a pretty straightforward process.
Yeah. So now, once you've got the sorbates in there, now you can consider back sweetening if you want to,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I never.
And of course, walk us through the back sweetening. Why do you do it and what does it do?
All right. First off, I skip the sorbate step if I'm not going to back sweeten. There's no reason to do it. So it has no basis for use if you're not sweetening. So the back sweetening is, you know, now you're going to adjust the quote final gravity of the mead to what tastes best to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to do this basically by building up a bench test. I'm going to take some small little measured samples and, you know, add a little bit and at one end, and four times as much at the other end, and a couple samples in between, and decide, okay, this one's a little too dry, this one's a little too sweet, by going from left to right or whichever order you put them in, and hone in on the two samples that one's too sweet and one's not sweet enough, and then do another step where I'm going to do a narrower, you know, maybe the first one I added 10 grams of sweetness more each sample as I work the left to right. The next time, now that I've narrowed it in between, you know, 20 grams and 30 grams, now I want it for the same measured amount, figure out it, you know, go by maybe 2 grams extra per measured sample. So I want to find out what the best one is in there, and mm-hmm. then scale that quantity up to the whole batch.
Now, have you ever played with one technique I used a couple times was, you know, if I didn't perfectly hit my final gravity that I was targeting,
there's another reason. Yeah.
Can I just adjust to target that final gravity?
You sure can.
Yeah.
You sure can. The other way I've done this blending to adjust the sweetness level is mix it with a sweeter finished mead.
Right.
And, right. There's the risk there that you could be diluting the flavor. If I'm trying to adjust a big fruity melomel and I'm trying to make it sweeter using just a straight sweet traditional mead, then I'm going to dilute some of the fruit flavor if I have to add very much. So there is that hazard along the way.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, let's see, some other topics. You've been toying with some new fermentation adjuncts. Can you walk us through some of these yeast-derived adjuncts? I'm not even familiar with what they are.
Okay, so, you know, these aren't necessarily new ideas. If you look in the Scott Labs handbook, and they used to call it their fermentation handbook, and mm-hmm. for 2020, I think they call it their Scott Labs winemaking handbook. Basically the same as always. It's a big PDF file you can find on their website for free. And they just publish all kinds of data. They don't make all this stuff. Some of it, I think, is actually their product, but they publish stats on many of the wine yeast strains and the ingredients we, you know, may like to use, mm-hmm. particularly for the winery use industry, but also for cider and meads. So they have a bunch of adjuncts, fermentation adjuncts. They have a few that are yeast derived. So basically they've, the producer, which I think in the case of the yeast derived ones, I think is Lallemand, but I'm not positive. They have things called Opti Red and Opti White. And so they're derived and intended for red wines or white wines. And I think of, well, okay, it's got some red fruits in, that's a red wine, and, you know, it's got mostly lighter colored, so it's a white wine. In any case, what these things are used, you know, you can add them, and you can read more detail in their little write-up. You can add them at primary fermentation, which I typically do. Just, you know, in the last, I don't know, year plus, I've been almost religiously always putting one packet of these into my batch at the start. You can also use them post-fermentation for slightly different effects. So what the idea here is to kind of mellow some of the characters, you know, help pull them together by, you know, taking advantage of some of the complex organics that are coming out of the spent yeast that they derive this from.
Mm-hmm. What are the specifics products that you're looking at?
So I'm looking at, let's see, check my cheat sheet here. So one of them is called Opti Red, OPTI-Red, and the other's Opti-White.
I've heard of those, yeah.
Yeah, and they have several others in that range, but those are the ones I've used a fair amount lately. You don't use very much. I mean, we're talking only a very few grams in a 5-gallon batch.
And I think these aren't they acids, right? Are they acid blends? I'm trying to remember.
Well, they're derived from yeast. I don't believe they're acids.
Okay.
they don't really tell you, but they're called yeast derived. So they're somehow extracted from spent yeast.
Mm-hmm. What do they do for you?
Well, they're going to increase the mouthfeel a little bit, give you a little more character, and that way, perhaps a little smoother body. They're going to kind of pull some flavors together. It's subtle. These are not things that are essential, I should say. These are a step that you could play with when you're already making pretty good stuff and you're trying to really, make some minor changes to what you're doing.
And of course, they're primarily intended for wine originally, right?
Yes, it's where they were developed. And of course, in Scott Labs, if you look at their catalog, and unless you're a commercial mead maker, they're probably not the place you're going to buy from, because most of these things are available. Probably the small quantity is like a half kilo package.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, you need a few grams per batch. So
it goes a long way.
You can find most of these kind of things at some of the better homebrew shops as well in small packages.
Yeah, and I've seen winemaking in particular, there's a lot of places that carry these kinds of things.
Yep.
So have you had good luck with these then?
I think so. And I have not done side-by-side. And, if I was trying to do this scientifically, I should, split a batch and do half with and half without and compare and all that. And I just haven't done that.
Okay. But you think there's some benefit to them?
It's one of those things to up your game beyond just, all the normal things you would do.
And then the other thing you mentioned been playing with is, I think tannins, right? Are you using wine tannins?
Yes. And again, there are a whole bunch of these in Scott Labs, a little handbook talks about them. And so in this case, again, you can use these in primary fermentation or add them later in the process to adjust. Instead of just being, quote, tannin, they have a range of them. I think they all start with FT for fermentation tannin. And so they have like a FT Blanc for white, FT Blanc soft, so it's a little softer tannin. These, again, improve the structure a little bit and, add a little more complexity to your mead. And so the Blanc family are for whitish meads for me. And then they have FT Rouge and FT Rouge Soft, which are the similar kind of things for the red ones. And one that, to me, for big fruit meads, is just seems like, a natural. They have one called FT Rouge Berry, and this one's supposed to help, bring a little character of a few berry notes, I'll give you a little hints of strawberry, cherry, maybe blueberry in the background from some fermentation tannins. And, that just sounds like a perfect thing if you're making a berry mead.
And of course, one of the risks here, I think you're making, I assume, fairly large meads here with, fairly high finishing gravity, right?
But I think where some of these have bigger value is if you're making smaller meads, because these are going to give you a little bit of more structure and complexity. There's not a lot there in a small mead sometimes to come across as rich in the mouth.
Right. You mentioned honey is almost all sugared. So when you take a low gravity mead, it's going to basically ferment down to almost nothing, right?
Yeah. And so what you're trying to do by playing with some of these adjuncts is to get just a little more tiny nuance of structure and character that could help the overall perception of this product.
Which comes from acid primarily, right?
The tannic acids. And so these are going to react with some of the other compounds that are present in the wine/mead must, and react during fermentation and other times. I mean, the handbook gives you some guidance. If you put this in as some of these tannins post fermentation, they give some guidance of how many days or weeks you should wait before packaging, because post-fermentation tannin addition usually takes quite a while to stabilize because the stuff slowly drops out. And so if you package too soon, you know, as a commercial producer into nice, pretty bottles and you have all the sediment sitting there, people don't like it.
So how do you use these effectively? When do you add them?
Been adding them right as soon as I mix up the must.
Okay. So right up front in the very beginning.
Right. And again, these are all these fermentation tannins are in the, you know, a handful of grams for a 5-gallon batch.
Right. And then there's one more thing you mentioned to me was some bodybuilding adjuncts. Are these?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know how.
I didn't know you were a bodybuilder.
Well, not lately. You can't go to the gym.
Yeah.
You know how certain, you know, brewers, you know, say you were trying to make, you know, some pastry style salad or something, you know, people have played some games with, say, lactose and maltodextrin sometimes to enhance the beverage for certain aspects. So it's kind of on a whim last Thanksgiving, I decided, well, you know, instead of just making a pumpkin chiffon pie, I'm going to make a pumpkin chiffon mead. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of went at it the same way. It was a, you know, session mead. It was, you know, 5-6%. And it had pumpkin in it, and it had maltodextrin and lactose and the usual pumpkin pie spices. And, you know, it hit what I wanted. Unfortunately, I think most people preferred the pumpkin pie better.
Oh, really?
Well, you know.
So it's a low gravity mead, and what you're doing is you're enhancing the sweetness through lactose, yeah, I guess? Or?
Yeah, the lactose and the maltodextrin being unfermentable sugars. And they're, you know, as you know, they're pretty not sweet, really. I mean, lactose is a sugar, but it doesn't come across super sweet.
Right.
And so it kind of gives you that creamy mouthfeel that I was looking for in that particular beverage. It was kind of a goofy idea, but I think it worked.
Interesting. So lactose, maltodextrin, primarily the two. Have you tried any other adjuncts? Not yet.
I don't think there's any others that I've tried lately. I guess and all the others were just, you know, were just different sugar sources.
Well, another topic we want to talk about was blending. And of course, winemakers have developed blending into a fine art over many thousands of years, actually.
Yeah, if you were a winemaker, you don't survive without being able to blend different tanks and barrels. And so I approach it from a different point of view because I rarely make, you know, two or three fermenters of the same thing in a given year. And so instead, I'm blending different meads.
Right.
I take an aronia mead and a mulberry mead and a black currant mead and some tart cherries and a couple others. You know, you get the idea. And I, you know, blend them into a glass.
Mm-hmm.
And that one looks pretty good. Okay, well, yeah, let's try it if I add a little more black raspberry to that. And it's amazing what you can do to a mead by this post-fermentation blending.
Mm-hmm. So have you had good luck with this, I guess?
Yes, I think it's worked really good. At least satisfies me. One of the things I haven't done, and I'm actually kick myself for not trying this before, is I think all I have to do is put some RO water in a keg and, you know, and I can, you know, blend down and, you know, and even make lower alcohol meads.
Yeah, I did that one time with some sack mead that just was way too sweet. Of course, there's some risk of re-fermentation happening, but.
Right. Well, like I said, I've mostly been doing these for serving. So either I'm putting them into a growler or a swing tuck. Top bottle to take somewhere, or they're not leaving the house. So, you know, it's not like they're for long-term packaging.
And then I think the other technique that, other place where this is used a lot is with braggots, right?
Right. Yes. Almost all the brackets I've made have been actually fermented brackets, where the beer and the mead were blended at primary. Many people only make them post fermentation.
Yeah, I certainly think that's the easy way to do it, is to make a big beer and a big mead and throw them together, you know.
Yeah, and a number of people I know make piments that way as well. They'll ferment a wine and a mead and blend them later.
Interesting. Yeah, I think blending in general is overlooked, particularly by beer makers.
It's such an easy way to either extend the range of what you have available or to adjust. I mean, I've been known to make a really big sweet mead just so I could use it for blending with other meads.
Yeah, and I think I mentioned I made this one mead that was sack mead that was way over the top, and I eventually turned most of that into a braggot myself.
Yeah, there you go.
But now, are there any risks with blending? Like we mentioned, the possibility of re-fermentation and so on?
Yes, there is. And so if you're doing this to package, you do need to pay attention. So if the meads are stabilized, you know, you're okay. If they aren't, if they haven't been stabilized, then for example, if one was bone dry and hadn't been stabilized and you blend a sweet one with it, if they aren't both at their alcohol limit for the yeast strains, you blend them, you're going to restart fermentation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is a risk, certainly.
And that's one of the reasons why you might stabilize if you plan to do this later. And it's an easy step.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so a related topic we were talking about before the show actually was managing the pH of your mead. Now, you mentioned you don't have too much trouble with it in your area, but I've run into the cases where, particularly making some of these big acidic fruit meads, where the pH starts to drop too low during fermentation.
Yeah, it is an issue for some people, and I did get a question from a guy I've known for years elsewhere in the country, who he decided to try to make a mead with RO water. And needless to say, he had lots of problems because the pH was going to go out of whack there.
Yeah, I mean, what happens with me, and I have the water I have is out of a well, but it's almost pure water. There's just a little bit of alkalinity in it. And when I'm making these big fruit meads, a lot of times the pH will drop. And how low can you let it go? I usually try and stop it around 3, but.
Yeah, if you go any lower than that, I think most yeast strains become quite unhappy.
Yeah.
I mean, when you think about it, 3 is quite low. A lot of lambics are probably right in that neighborhood.
Right. So so what can you use to get the pH up, which is kind of the opposite of what most homebrewers do?
To get the pH up, let's see, you can go with chalk.
Yeah, not very soluble, though.
No. And it's, so, you know, what you have to do is you would have to put that in at the start, mix it into your water. See, what else would you use?
I think the one I've been using is, I'm working off the top of my head here, but I think it's potassium bicarbonate.
Yeah.
I think that's right.
Yeah, that probably works too.
Yeah. You put a couple teaspoons in or something like that, and it usually drives it up by a couple tenths and kind of back in business.
And the other thing I've known some people have done is they've used a dilute potassium hydroxide solution to adjust, to keep the fermentation in the proper range.
I mean, technically, you could use something as insane as lye, but you know, you just don't want to work with that.
Basically, what the hydroxide is, you just got to be careful. It's pretty caustic.
It's very caustic. Yeah, it's very dangerous. I don't recommend that. The potassium bicarbonate you can get at a lot of homebrewing shops.
It's not dangerous.
much less dangerous.
Yeah.
Anyways, I want to get your closing thoughts on mead and new mead techniques and.
Well, you know, mead is such a fun thing. It's such a broad spectrum in comparison to, most of the alcoholic beverage world. I mean, you think about mead, it's sweet, it's dry, it's sparkling, it's still, it's got fruit, it doesn't, it's got cereal grains in it, it's got spices, whatever you want. It's almost impossible for somebody to say they don't like mead. It just means they haven't found the one they like yet.
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly had some mediocre meads in my time, but
sure. But I mean, if a well-made mead, you know, you can say, oh, I don't like it because I don't like that fruit, or I don't like dry meads. Okay, well, here's a sweet mead, or I, you know, here's one with a different fruit, or here's one with a different spice. Unless they don't like alcohol, well, in that case, then mead's probably not for them. But it has such a broad range of flavors and aromas potential that it's hard not to find some characteristics there that meets your desire.
Yep. I like I said, for me, it was the big fruit meads, just absolutely fantastic.
And I love the big fruit meads, the fruit bombs, the Ken Schramm style, you know, fruit, you know, many pounds per gallon.
I agree. Yeah. Well, Steve, thank you again for coming on the show. I really appreciate you being here.
It's always good to chat.
It was great having my guest today. It was Steve Piatz. He's the author of the book, The Complete Guide to Mead Making, and was also 2008 Mead Maker of the Year. Steve, thanks again.
Glad to be here.
A big thank you to Steve Piatz for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the Brew Commander, the new complete brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a digital brewhouse controller with high precision and the ultimate in flexibility. The Brew Commander offers automated mash step boil times, boil timers, and the advanced brew day settings. Command your brew day with a new Brew Commander. To order yours today, visit BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And Beersmith 3 is available on both desktop and mobile platforms. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider support to the amazing Beersmith platform, new Whirlpool hop options, support for high-altitude brewing, and a whole lot more. To check out Beersmith 3 and get your free 21-day trial, go to beersmith.com today. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.